Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. Here in just a few minutes, we'll have some audio open lines. But in between time, we need to talk with Wesley Smith, Senior Fellow for the Discovery Institute, about the conversation we just had and about the subject we were just covering, the Pew Forum poll on Oregon's Death with Dignity law. Now, it's been 10 years since the law became law officially, although the law was actually passed in 1994. Then there were court challenges and whatnot. 1997, this month, 10 years that Oregon has had the Death with Dignity Act, and we wanted to hear what Wesley Smith thought about it 10 years down the line. He's a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, and he's attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's authored several books, including Forced Exit, Euthanasia, Assisted Suicide, and The New Duty to Die. Wesley, welcome back.
Hey, Todd, how are you?
I'm doing well. So what kind of an anniversary is 10 years of Death with Dignity, as they say, in Oregon?
That's a nice euphemism, isn't it? I think it's a sad and tragic anniversary. In Oregon, they have transformed suicide into a medical treatment. And what's really ironic is Oregon is having a terrible problem with youth suicide. I think it's got the 10th highest suicide rate in the nation. The Department of Health there has publicly warned against elder suicide, and they don't seem to understand why they're having such a problem with suicide. Well, one of the problems might be that when you legalize suicide for some people, say that doctors can assist it and rather than try to prevent it, it's pretty hard to say to other suffering people, well, you don't commit suicide. That's only for people with cancer. It also is an interference with proper hospice care. A lot of these people who committed suicide with the help of their doctors were in hospice. And if you're in a hospice and somebody finds out that you're suicidal, what's supposed to happen under hospice philosophy is that the multidisciplinary team is informed. I've been a hospice volunteer. I've worked with dying people. And I was trained over 12 weeks. If you find that somebody asks for suicide or says, I wish I were dead, you tell the hospice team, because that means there may be something that patient is not receiving that could be given to that patient to alleviate that despair. When you instead assist the suicide of somebody with a doctor referred by, which usually happens or at least often happens, from an assisted suicide advocacy group, you're interfering with that proper application of compassionate medical treatment. So it's a terrible situation. The state of Oregon keeps statistics that are completely empirically unreliable and unverifiable. And so the whole thing is kind of a mess.
Okay, talking about the statistics, they say that a reported 292 cases of physician-assisted suicide have occurred in Oregon since the law came into effect in 1997. Is there any reason why you would be suspicious about the number 292 in this case?
Well, it's unreliable. In fact, the reports from Oregon itself, the annual statistics say all we know is what the prescribing doctors tell us. In fact, all they do know in terms of who has received a lethal prescription is what the prescribing doctors tell them. There is no oversight over the process. There's a little bit of looking at some death certificates, although they're not even listed as assisted suicide. The death certificates list the underlying disease, which means it's not true. There are no autopsies. And then when the annual statistics are put together and published, they're destroyed. So there is no way to know whether the 292 is an accurate number or not. The Oregon Department of Health or State Department of Health and Human Services admits this. The media doesn't describe that aspect of it. In fact, that number would be inadmissible in a court of law because it would be completely unverifiable and hearsay.
So they're basically depending upon the doctors who carry out the physician-assisted suicide.
Right.
To report on their own activity.
That's correct. And they're about as likely to tell the state that they broke the law as they are to tell the IRS they cheated on their taxes. But even if they did tell the state they broke the law, the state doesn't have the budget or the legal authority under the Department of Health and Human Services to even investigate. So they are handcuffed, not that they would necessarily want to investigate, but the state department that supposedly oversees this is completely handcuffed. They don't have legal authority, and they don't have a budget to investigate these things. If they think there's something wrong, they refer it to the the physician licensing board. It's a joke. And yet, just imagine, Todd, if the president of the United States today, George Bush, issued a report about what has happened in Iraq and how many al-Qaeda terrorists have been killed, the media would be skeptical and would try to find out whether it was true and would do research, which is their job. I'm not complaining. Oregon issues these statistics based on no verifiability, and the media just spouts it as if it's true without any questioning, no skepticism. It's astonishing.
What were the original arguments in Oregon in favor of the Death with Dignity Act?
Well, they're the ones you still hear today, that this is my body, aimed against the Catholic Church. It was an anti-Catholic campaign. There were radio ads such as saying, Pope, keep your hands off my body, that kind of thing. The initiative, which was called Measure 16, was sold saying this would only be for those people with unrelievable suffering as a last resort. Of course, there's nothing in the law that requires it to be reserved for unrelievable suffering, which is almost always a false premise anyway, or a last resort. So, there was a lot of scare tactics about people who couldn't suffer pain. There was a nurse named Patty Rosen who said that she assisted the suicide of her daughter by giving her pills, and that the daughter had bone cancer, and that for the first time in years she'd been able to hug her daughter. Well, it turned out just before the election, and this never really got out widely, Patty Rosen had not assisted the suicide of her daughter. She had lethally injected her. And yet that was not widely reported by the media. It only came to light about 2 or 3 days before the election. So it was high on emotionalism, high on distortion, high on demagoguery. And at that time, the disability rights activists, who I think are the most powerful and potent opponents of assisted suicide in this country, had not engaged the issue. And so it was presented as, the rational secularists and modernists versus the deep, dark religionists and religiously motivated pro-lifers. And Oregon is a very secular state. And even so, it only won by 51% to 49%, despite being ahead in the polls early on in the high 60s.
California, your state, Wesley, has made several attempts to follow in Oregon's footsteps.
Indeed.
And I imagine the same arguments have been trotted out. Why has a Death with Dignity Act not been successful in California, where one might expect even more than Oregon, it could be successful? If it could make it there, it could certainly make it in California.
Well, I've been hip deep in fighting the legislation here in California. I've testified in front of the state Senate and so forth. What's happened since 1994, and I think this has made the difference, is the disability rights folk who are part of the Democratic Party's coalition and are basically left-wing in terms of their political views, secular in terms of their cultural views, and tend to be pro-choice in terms of abortion. The disability rights community, shortly after the passage of Measure 16 in Oregon, came to realize that they were the ultimate targets of this agenda. And they came to realize that because Jack Kevorkian, as you will recall, at that time was assisting the suicide of people almost with impunity to general applause of society. But most of Kevorkian's victims, I'll use that term, were not terminally ill. Most were disabled and depressed. And the disability rights folks saw people applauding, and they realized that once you start saying that because we have personal autonomy, that includes the right to choose the time, manner, and place of death, which is one of the ideological bulwarks of assisted suicide advocacy, they call it the ultimate civil right. And the second ideological bulwark is that killing is an acceptable answer to human suffering. Once you accept those two premises, what in the world does dying or being terminally ill have to do with it? There are a lot of people who are far more suffer far longer and far more intensely in this world than dying people. And so they decided to engage the issue. And that has made all the difference. Since about 1995, 96, when the disability rights folk really got on, came riding to the rescue like the cavalry, the assisted suicide movement in America has been moribund. They've been unable to move the ball forward at all. And it's because it cuts across that stereotype of only religious right-wingers opposing assisted suicide, because you've got very liberal folk opposing it. It cuts across the idea that the people who oppose assisted suicide don't care about human suffering, because a lot of the very opponents are suffering. And it highlights that one of the problems with assisted suicide is that it could become a substitute for proper care. And so that, I think, has made a difference. And, you know, we've been able to get our arguments out there a little better than perhaps we did in Oregon. But it's a constant fight. These people are indomitable. They believe in their agenda. They are ideologically driven. They're not discouraged when they lose. They just keep coming back again and again. And so this is going to be a struggle, I think, that will be with us for the foreseeable future.
I wanted to ask you about the polling data. Not necessarily in particular what Pew finds, but I think this is found in many polls when it comes to the issue of physician-assisted suicide or right to die. Depending on how you word it, you get a different result. The Pew poll says when they asked people about physician-assisted suicide, they found people largely opposed. But when they asked about whether or not terminally ill patients should be given the means to end their lives, then there is a small majority in favor of it. What's going on there?
There's two points to be made. First off, the fact that even with the very loosely worded question, that it's a bare majority that favors it shows that the opposition has had an impact. It used to be you'd have majorities in favor of this agenda in the 60s and 70s percentile. Secondly, when you use accurate and descriptive words, such as suicide, people are forced to think about what it is we're really talking about. And that's why the assisted suicide advocacy groups are trying to change the lexicon. They like their current euphemism of choice is aid in dying. And so they will say things like the doctor provided, and they use the AID, AID. I mean, it's ludicrous, and they realize that unless they use euphemisms, unless they try to actually mask and cover up and obfuscate what it is that they're actually proposing, they are not going to prevail. And so that is why you begin to see, it's been going on for a while, the assisted suicide advocacy folks constantly looking for just the right words, just the right term, just the right turn of a phrase that will allow them to carry the day. But what they are proposing is hard and it's cold. It is saying to somebody who is suffering and suicidal, if you have a certain disease, we'll give you pills. If that same person was suffering and suicidal, let's say because their children had died, then supposedly we'd give them suicide prevention, which shows the discriminatory nature of assisted suicide advocacy. But this whole idea of terminal illness is just a way station. There's no way it can remain permanent because, as I said before, once you accept the premises of assisted suicide advocacy, dying has nothing to do with it. And, in fact, already in this country, before assisted suicide is even widely legalized, you see advocacy in some of the highest medical and professional journals, the latest being the Hastings Center Report, which is the most prestigious bioethics journal in the world, advocating for assisted suicide right for the mentally ill. That has already been made a constitutional right in Switzerland, which permits assisted suicide. Now it's also for the mentally ill, and it's been made a right in the Netherlands, which permits assisted suicide too. So once you accept the agenda that killing is an acceptable answer to human suffering, and radical individualism, that is, I have the right to choose the time, manner, and place of my own death, then you're basically looking towards, sooner or later, death on demand.
Laying aside the obvious ethical issues, the Oregon law, the Death with Dignity Act, is it simply, from a purely legal standpoint, a bad law?
Well, yeah, it's extremely bad in the sense that it offers, just as one example, no real protections against abuse. Let me just talk about two aspects of this. There's more, but I know we've got a time constraint. First of all, there's the phenomenon of doctor shopping. The very first patient who was known as Mrs. A, who committed assisted suicide, and the Compassion in Dying folks held a big press conference, it turned out that when she went to her own doctor asking for assisted suicide, he said no. She then went to another doctor asking for assisted suicide, who said no because you're depressed. So she went to the Compassion and Dying folks, now called Choices and Compassion and Choices, and got referred to a what I call a death doctor, because he was not there to treat her. He was there to just write a prescription, like a Kevorkian situation. And he wrote her the prescription. She'd known her doctor who wrote the prescription 2.5 weeks before she died. Doctor shopping shows that, you know, one of the premises is, well, your own doctor will have a good relationship with you. Baloney. You just go doctor to doctor to doctor until you find one who'll give you the pills. That shows there's no protection in terms of your own doctor for these patients. Secondly, once the prescription is written, there are no protections of any kind whatsoever. The doctor doesn't have to be present. Before the pills are taken, there doesn't have to be an analysis to make sure the patient knows what he or she is doing. There certainly is no advance notice to the state. And the death certificates are what I would call falsified, although it's legal, to say that the death was not by assisted suicide, which would be the fact of the matter, but say by cancer or by Lou Gehrig's disease or whatever it might be. So just in terms of what they claim to want to do, protect against abuse, does not succeed.
Wesley Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He has authored several books, including Forced Exit, Euthanasia, Assisted Suicide, and The New Duty to Die. You can stay informed on issues bioethical at Wesley's website, wesleyjsmith.com, wesleyjsmith.com. Wesley, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd. It's good to talk to you as always.
Folks, Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief are, like Issues, Etc., committed to defending life from beginning to end. You can find out about their work at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call 1-888-930-4438. You can earmark a donation for LCMS Life Ministries, 1-888-930-4438, Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. Well, moving on to something a little more lighthearted and segueing into a bit of audio that we have on issues dealing with Islam and Muslims. You would not expect this, but it's true. You've got your stewardess Barbie. You've got your cheerleader Barbie. You've got your homemaker Barbie. You've got your working girl Barbie. You've got every kind of Barbie you could possibly want. It was only a matter of time before someone came up with the idea of a Muslim Barbie. It's audio open lines. This story comes from Reuters.
Her features are distinctly European, but Salma's association with the West stops there. Skimpy clothing is out, and Muslim dress is in. Salma is the creation of Sukumawati Suryaman. The 28-year-old mother of one started producing the doll last year after she saw her niece playing with a Barbie figure that she felt didn't embody Muslim values.
When I saw my niece playing with the Barbie doll, I thought, I wish we had these dolls in traditional garb that fits our tradition. As we all know, children are easily influenced and often imitate their toys.
Salma is available in 20 outfits, ranging from a formal black abaya to a pink glittery robe with matching headscarf. Her popularity is growing in Indonesia, as many mothers see Salma as a welcome alternative role model for their daughters.
Barbie wears skimpy clothes while Salma dresses in a respectable way with a headscarf.
8-year-old Nabila is an instant convert.
She's so cute in her long sleeves and ankle-length dress.
Sales have gone up as Eid approaches, when Muslims celebrate the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. For now, Salma is only available in Indonesia, but Suryaman hopes to start exporting the doll to neighboring Muslim countries. Helen Long, Reuters.
I don't know, can you call it a Barbie doll if it isn't Barbie and if it isn't dressed the way Barbie's usually dressed? But if you could see the video, you can see there is this doll in various Muslim garb, always with the headscarf, sometimes with almost a full burqa, although one wonders, why would you have a doll that's completely covered over with a burqa? I guess if you're a Muslim, that has some value to you. I remember my daughter, as a very little girl, we would get her baby dolls, and I think probably every little girl does this, at least at that age before they start trying to dress their dolls up. They undress their dolls. In fact, she had a whole series of baby dolls, all the same kind of baby doll. We would bring it home from the toy store, put it in her hands. The first thing she'd do, off would come the bonnet, the socks, the little pants, and the little blouse, and it was naked baby. We actually ended up calling it clean baby because she would get it so dirty, we'd have to go out and get her another one. It was only $6, and it would be all nice and clean when she took all the clothes off the next one. And in the mind of a three-year-old, that was practically a miracle. I think we have 8 or 9 clean babies down in one of our storage tubs in the basement. We'll give them to her when she gets married. I think we actually kept all the clothes, too. No burkas in clean baby's wardrobe. Well, we had this piece of audio yesterday, and unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to get to it, but this is really an interesting story. It is the month of Ramadan, the last few days of Ramadan, and as Ramadan draws to a close, it's a whole month-long celebration of fasting and prayer carried out by devout Muslims. As it comes to a close, what happens is everybody needs to be fasting and observing it, even astronauts. Here's an interesting story about a Muslim astronaut who plans to celebrate Ramadan.
Final preparations being made in Kazakhstan for Malaysia's giant leap. A train slowly transports the Russian rocket that will fly Sheikh Muzaffar Shakur to the International Space Station. Mr. Shakur, a 34-year-old doctor, isn't the first Muslim in space. But he's not made things easy for himself by taking off during the fasting month of Ramadan.
I'm going to space during those fasting months. I will be doing my fasting and prayers in space. I do hope to be an example not only to the Malaysian people, but to all the Muslim people all over the world. I just want to say that Islam is very lenient. Islam is a way of life. So if I would like to be an example that you should do your responsibilities anywhere, even though whether you are on Earth or you are in space.
In Malaysia, Mr. Shakur is a national celebrity, and an 18-page booklet has been published to help him know which direction Mecca is while he orbits, and also when to pray. With the space station going round the Earth 16 times a day, and the sun continually rising and setting, he could, in theory, be expected to pray 80 times every 24 hours. Alongside Mr. Shakur in the launch capsule will be a Russian pilot and an American astronaut. Once settled into the space station, he's expected to speak to Malaysian students and Prime Minister before celebrating the end of Ramadan sometime this weekend. Jonah Fisher, BBC News.
Well, you know, you got to hand it to a Muslim who is willing to, even if he's going to spend time on the International Space Station, still wants to observe the tenets of his religion. Would that more Christians would do this. But I do wonder about that praying 80 times every 24 hours because it's tied to sunset and sundown. And, of course, when you're orbiting the Earth at, 16,000-17,000 miles an hour, you got a lot of sunsets and a lot of sundowns and, therefore, a lot of prayers. I imagine he won't be praying on that sunup sundown schedule. I think he's probably got work to do on the space station, too. More audio open lines after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you have a problem delegating? Have you ever been called bossy? Hi, I'm Dr. Mark. Join my co-hosts Michelle Bauer and me on Life Revised as we discuss the control freaks of this world. Are you one? Learn how to begin allowing yourself to let go so others can enjoy your company. Do you know or work with one? Get practical tips on how to get along with control freaks so that you can live in peace on Life Revised.
Saturday mornings at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Our guests on the next Focus on the Family are Lisa Turkhurst, author of Capture His Heart and co-founder of Proverbs 31 Ministries, and her husband Art. They'll share candidly about God's intervention in their marriage, telling how they learned to communicate effectively through the ups and downs of their relationship. Tune in for a practical and encouraging discussion on the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Kim Troby, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. Widespread reports indicate Congressman Henry Waxman is launching an investigation of conservative talk show icons Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Mark Levin. The search would culminate in Capitol Hill hearings, all as a means of resurrecting the Fairness Doctrine, a measure that muzzles conservative speech. Steve Jordahl explains.
And they're killing women and children. Why does someone say it's a bloodthirsty religionist practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks and where to kill them?
Sure, they're strident, none more than Michael Savage. But can Congress weigh in and mandate content of conservative talk shows? Congressman Waxman flatly denies it, but the American Spectator is reporting the California Democrat is calling for an investigation of some of America's most vocal conservative voices. Craig Parshall is with National Religious Broadcasters.
The power to investigate is the power to harass. And I think there is a potential for harassment, not only of conservative talk, but Christian talk radio as well. Christian stations exist to proclaim the truth of the gospel, to be able to give an alternate voice to the mainstream media, and that would be the worst thing that could happen.
Regardless of Waxman's intent to call an investigation, the pink elephant in the halls of Congress is a Democratic push to reauthorize the Fairness Doctrine. Gary McCaleb of the Alliance Defense Fund will do what it takes to oppose a reintroduction of the law.
For Christian broadcasters to possibly be threatened with having to invite people directly opposed to their position in to give their side of the story, outrageous infringement on First Amendment and free exercise.
He says if that comes to pass, ADF will be in court defending the right of religious broadcasters. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Experts note similarities between the current schism and the Red Scare of the 50s, when conservatives told liberals who they could and could not talk with. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton with an audio memo about some of the things happening on The Morning Show. We've got two promotions underway, one involving CPH and their warehouse sale. We'll be giving you an opportunity to call and register for one of four $50 gift certificates redeemable at the CPH warehouse sale on November 3rd. So listen for an opportunity to call and register. And then, in a separate promotion, listen for a chance to play Bible Brain Teaser and win the latest VeggieTales DVD on AM 850 KFUO.
Etc. Regular guest, Dr. Jeff Walls, is the co-author of our book of the month for October, Lutheran Pastors and Politics, Issues in the Public Square. You can learn more from Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or find the book cover on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Lutheran Pastors and Politics costs $27.99 plus shipping and handling. Lutheran Pastors and Politics, our Issues Etc. book of the month for October.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's Audio Open Lines. Halfway through the program, we're coming to you live this Thursday, October the 11th. You can join us with any of your thoughts or comments. We've heard about the Muslim Barbie doll, although I don't think it's a, I think it's a Selma doll or a Salma doll. It's hard to tell what the name is, dressed in a burqa or in at least a very modest headscarf and full length, both in sleeves and in dress length robe. I guess in Malaysia, they're just really happy about this. It's selling like hotcakes because part of the tradition of Ramadan, of course, is after Ramadan is all over with, there's a big celebration, the fasting is over, and the kids get presents. At the same time, we have an astronaut in space going to the International Space Station as a Muslim, planning to observe the last few days of Ramadan there. So from the Muslim Barbie doll to the Muslim astronaut observing Ramadan. One of the things you might not hear about Pakistan as often as you should is about the Islamist problem that they have there. Now, Pakistan is in many ways has been in the past something of a model for Islamic countries. There is a Christian population there. It's not as easy as it could be. We had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, a Christian from Pakistan. He talked about the difficulties there. But there is a growing Islamist problem in that country. Here's the story from National Public Radio.
With everything else that happens in the region, it's easy to forget that Pakistan is fighting a war within its own borders. This week, that war is very much on the minds of Pakistanis. Pakistan's army has moved into a tribal region called North Waziristan. It's been fighting Islamist militants, and since Saturday, an estimated 250 people have been killed. NPR's Philip Reeves reports on Pakistan's deadliest fighting in years.
Pakistan bans the media from going to the mountainous tribal areas along its border with Afghanistan. Communications are also terrible. Yet the scraps of information that have emerged suggest fighting there has been unusually intense. They speak of artillery barrages, of attacks by Pakistani helicopters and jets, of civilian casualties in an airstrike on a village bazaar, and of thousands fleeing. This surge in fighting comes at a particularly difficult time for Pakistan's government. For months, General Pervez Musharraf, who's Army Chief of Staff, has had his mind on other problems. He's been concentrating on surviving in office by securing another 5 years as president. Yet violence in Pakistan's tribal belt has been intensifying, and so has a debate among Pakistanis about how to deal with it.
The situation has become so bad, sir, that Pakistani troops on occasions have been willing to give up arms and surrender rather than fight.
Tariq Fatemi is a former ambassador for Pakistan to Washington. He's referring to an event that's deeply shocked this country. Nearly 6 weeks ago, more than 200 soldiers were taken hostage, apparently after surrendering. They're still being held by militants. The reputation of Pakistan's once revered military has hit a low point, but Fatemi says the main problem's not the quality of the army.
The Pakistan armed forces are absolutely first rate, there's no doubt about it. But by using them in operations against the people of Pakistan, many of whom are related to the soldiers who are going there in the operations, it has created tremendous unhappiness, disquiet amongst the soldiers and amongst civic society.
One reason for this unhappiness is that many Pakistanis believe their troops are being used as proxies to fight Washington's war on terror. Anti-Americanism's already running very high in Pakistan, not least because of the US's role in Iraq and Afghanistan. But Tahir Hussain Mashadi, a Pakistani senator, thinks Pakistanis need to understand that the militants are also a serious threat to their society.
They want to take over not only my country, they want to take me over, they want to take over my soul.
Mashadi's a retired army colonel. He's served in the tribal belt. He knows how hard it is to defeat the militants.
Don't forget, they are fierce fighters. They're fighting on their own home ground. Local population is on their side.
On one issue, most Pakistanis seem to agree. Military force won't ultimately work in the tribal areas. The Pakistani military's long acknowledged this, and so has Musharraf.
We have to fight terrorism not for the international community, but for ourselves.
Musharraf says the solution is to combine force with economic development and dialogue. The US has promised $150 million a year to support this. But most Pakistani observers say that on the ground, nothing much has actually happened yet. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Islamabad.
All right, now Pakistan is an Islamic country. The debate here seems to be very similar to the debate. Now it's actually taking place on the ground there, and people are having to live it out. For us, it's a little more of an intellectual debate, a philosophical debate here in the West, although not for long. We got a story coming up here in just a moment about a political party in Great Britain, an Islamist political party in Great Britain, and a man who left it after having studied the Quran and coming to his own conclusion that Islam isn't about what the radical Muslims told him it was all about. But see, this really highlights the debate, whether you're talking about Pakistan or Great Britain. You're talking about two great questions. What is Islam? Is Islam the religion practiced by Muhammad and his immediate followers, which was at various times very peaceful and at other times very warlike, at sometimes kind of a passive minority and other times a very dominant majority? Is Islam what the Quran teaches, or is it what Muslims practice? You have peace-loving, politically integrated Muslims in the West, and then you have places like Great Britain where, although it's a thoroughly Western society, there is an element of Islam that is very radicalized. In fact, here's a story from National Public Radio. A young man who came out of a more radicalized political party and determined that what he had been a part of in this radical Islamic party was, in fact, not really Islam, but the Quran co-opted by totalitarian ambition. Let's listen.
The British have first-hand experience with homegrown terrorists, young, alienated British Muslims swayed by radical movements. And that's raised questions about one Muslim organization in the country, Hizb ut-Tahrir. The group is legal in Britain but banned in many countries. It requires members to adhere to the strictest interpretation of Islamic law and forbids participation in Western institutions, for example, no service in the police force or the army, and no voting in elections. Critics accuse the group of encouraging terrorism, a claim Hizb ut-Tahrir denies. Recently, a senior member left the group in Britain and then publicly criticized its ideology. NPR's Rob Gifford went to meet him.
A pot of couscous is being stirred in the kitchen of a small house in an unremarkable corner of North London as three Muslim men prepare to break their Ramadan fast with their families. For one of the three, this year's Ramadan has been particularly significant. For Majid Nawaz, it's his first Ramadan since he left the Islamist group Hizb ut-Tahrir. Nawaz was born in a commuter town just east of London, a third-generation British Muslim of Pakistani origin. It was while he was still in his teens, confused about his mixed identity, watching television and seeing Muslims being killed in Bosnia, that he was approached by an activist of Hizb ut-Tahrir, who seemed to offer black and white answers to his questions.
If the problem is one of Muslims being slaughtered by Serbs, then what we need, as they would say, is Muslims who would defend other Muslims, and that would require a Muslim army, and that would require a Muslim state. So we need an independent Islamic state that only serves the interests of Muslims and Islam.
Nawaz loved his newfound certainties and became a spokesperson and propagandist for Hizb ut-Tahrir, travelling to Pakistan and Denmark, as well as all over Britain, recruiting people to the cause. He rose to be one of the group's most senior members. Then, in 2001, he was arrested in Egypt, where Hizb ut-Tahrir is banned. It was while serving 4 years in an Egyptian jail, during which he says he was beaten and saw other prisoners tortured, that he immersed himself in the study of Islam.
I came to the conclusion that Islam is not the same as this Islamist ideology that Hizb ut-Tahrir are propagating. They have superimposed a political ideology upon Islam, upon my religion, and are presenting it as if it's one and the same as religion.
We're listening to this story from National Public Radio. This young man, a very young man in his 20s, a Muslim, lured into a radical Islamic sect. Later he'll even refer to it as a cult. It's I think it's a political party in Great Britain. And taught that, and this is not just in Great Britain, it's elsewhere in the world, legal in Great Britain, illegal elsewhere, has come to the conclusion after studying the Quran that he was duped, that Islam is not what his radical friends told him it was. Care to react? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, live this Thursday, the 11th of October, issuesetc@kfuo.org. As long as we've been dealing with the issue of Islam, and it's been now probably 6 or 7 years here on Issues Etc. intensely, the same question has always remained. Will the real Islam please stand up? What is Islam? Is Islam Osama bin Laden's worldview and religion, or is it the religion of westernized Muslims who have integrated into our society and still believe themselves to be devout Muslims? Now, see, the westernized Muslims will look at Osama bin Laden and they'll say, that's not real Islam. It's been co-opted by a totalitarian mindset, a political agenda, a terrorist impulse. But of course, if you go ask Osama bin Laden whether or not the westernized Muslims are real Muslims, he will tell you with a completely straight face, that is not real Islam. That has been co-opted by and corrupted by all these Western ideas that are foreign to the Quran and foreign to Islam. So I guess you get either at least two choices. Either westernized Islam is Islam, or Osama bin Laden's brand of Islam is Islam, or maybe both are, or maybe neither are. That's four choices so far. it's hard to put your finger on what it really is when you have Muslims over here saying, no, we're the real Muslims, and Muslims over here saying, no, we're the real Muslims. And here's this young man in Great Britain who for years believed that he was really truly being a devout Muslim, a Quran observant Muslim, and then came to the conclusion after studying the Quran that he had it all wrong. You'll hear in just a moment, he calls for Muslims to completely integrate into the political system of the United Kingdom and seek change in society and betterment for themselves through that political system. And he feels he's a better Muslim than he was when he was a member of the radical sect. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Now, as leads the prayers with his friends before they sit down to eat their meal, he says he has by no means lost his faith. It was understanding true Islam that rescued him from Islamism, which he now defines as using Islamic scripture to justify totalitarian ideology. His colleagues in Hizb ut-Tahrir were shocked when he finally left the group last month, a year after his release from jail. He says he had to overturn 12 years of indoctrination by Hizb ut-Tahrir, but now says HT, as he calls it, is much more than just a cult.
To describe them with the word cult perhaps underestimates the danger, because it's a political party with an ideology to push, to peddle through to the world. And so I think that we have to be careful, because HT are a political party that are intent on establishing a totalitarian state to implement their ideology, their man-made ideology, which is a result of modern political thinking superimposed upon Islam.
Despite now opposing Hizb ut-Tahrir, Nawaz says he does not want to see the group banned because he says at present they're not encouraging violence, and he says Islamism is different from Islamic terrorism. One of his main aims now is to try to help other British Muslims, often alienated by government policies at home and abroad, to integrate more into British life. He's still very critical of British government policy in the Middle East, especially Iraq, and of anti-terrorism legislation in Britain, which he says targets and alienates young British Muslims.
If they have, and they do have, issues with these policies, then they should try and redress these grievances from within the institutional frameworks of our country. And that can only occur if we first of all psychologically identify ourselves as British, and then we participate fully within these institutions as citizens, not as outsiders, but as people who have an equal stake in our own society.
Hizb ut-Tahrir did not respond to NPR's requests for an interview. Nawaz says he has received abusive emails and phone threats from some Islamists, but he says he did so much to encourage division between Muslims and non-Muslims that he now must repair that damage. As for his safety, he says he takes precautions, but he says ultimately it is in God's hands. Rob Gifford, NPR News, London.
You know, it just occurred to me that if, and this is a big if this is the real face of Islam, an integrated, politically assimilated, cooperative religion, a religion that does not have at its core any impulse toward violence or terrorism or war against the infidel. If this really is the true face of Islam, and I'm trying to suspend judgment here, although in the last 6 years my judgment has swayed back and forth. If it is, then apart from kind of idiotic Christians who want to tell us that we're all worshiping the same God, my concerns about Islam are really very small. If this is the real face of Islam. Apart from, as I said, the soft-headed Christians who think, you know, Muslim, Christian, what difference does it make? We're all worshiping the same God. If we can draw the line very clearly theologically between Christianity and Islam, as we do with other religions, and if this is the real face of Islam, a peaceful, peace-loving, politically cooperative religion that integrates into society insofar as it can, is devout to its own beliefs, why worry about Islam? Why worry about more Muslims in Great Britain or in Germany? We'll be talking about that tomorrow, by the way, when we broadcast from German Days at the SEM. Why worry about that? Now, I said that's a big if. If, on the other hand, Islam is something other than this peace-loving, politically cooperative, fully assimilated religion, of devout people, if it is more like what Osama bin Laden believes Islam is, then my concern about Islam is very big indeed. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for October is called Lutheran Pastors and Politics. It covers not only the involvement, but the opinions and the ideas of Lutheran pastors and political, social, moral issues. You can find out more about this book by going to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, and ask them about Lutheran pastors and politics. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for October, 1-800-325-3040.
Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be trouble.
Well, the question of staying or going for many Episcopalians in the United States isn't so much about leaving a church body, but finding for themselves leaders in worldwide Anglicanism who will continue to do for them what their bishops in the past have done and now in many cases are refusing to do. If we understand, you got to understand what Anglicanism is as a church structure. Bishops are really the locus, the place where the church is found. You don't baptize, you don't give the Lord's Supper, you don't ordain, you don't do a lot of things without the permission or the hands-on activity of your bishop. Now, this is kind of the way the church has structured itself. The majority of Christians have structured themselves for about the last two millennia of church history. It's not the only way that Christians can structure themselves, but it is the majority way that they've structured themselves. This presents a problem when your bishop won't ordain a pastor because he believes the Bible's true. Or your bishop won't come and do confirmations or maybe even baptisms at your church because he thinks your congregation is too conservative, too Bible-believing. So what do? Well, some Episcopalians are trying to work that out. Here's the story from National Public Radio.
The U.S. Episcopal Church has been estranged from parts of the global Anglican Communion since a church in New Hampshire consecrated a gay bishop. The controversy has abated somewhat, but many in the church now worry about another potential divide. Depending on your point of view, African bishops are either stealing American worshipers or rescuing them. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
It's a nasty, rainy Friday night, and yet nothing could keep these folks away. The largely white, middle-class crowd floods into the auditorium of Church of the Apostles in Fairfax, Virginia, tittering, eager to see the Anglican equivalent of a rock star. Archbishop Henry Luke Orambi takes to the stage. The introduction is brief and euphoric.
Would you welcome His Grace?
The 300 or so people jump to their feet. You almost expect them to hold up their lighters. Within minutes, he's got them.
I see a church that has to die to materialism and very poor politics. I see a church that has to die to arrogance. I see a church that must die and come back again.
The Ugandan cleric is leading a revolution. Orambi wants American evangelicals to challenge the reigning liberalism of the Episcopal Church.
And you guys here in this country, you prayed for the Episcopal Church so much. Lord, what are you waiting for? What is happening? And God seemed to just look at you, if he ever looks at you at all. Listen. Jesus, he comes at the right time.
And like any rock star, Orambi has his groupies, like Edwina Thomas.
He's an amazing preacher. He preaches from his heart. His smile is from ear to ear, and his eyes sparkle. What can I say? I'm in his fan club.
I felt like the truth had arrived, and this is our answer.
Bliss Miga, who is a cradle Episcopalian, says the American church has lost its way.
And he is saying, this is the real way. So we have a new father. He's our new father.
Henry Orambi is spiritual father to more than 9 million Anglicans. He's had close ties to evangelical churches in the United States for years. As the rift opened here over an openly gay bishop and blessing same-sex unions, the Ugandan leader offered to take conservative churches under his wing.
It's like there is a storm. Your neighbor runs to your porch.
You open the door for them to shelter from the storm, and when the storm is over, they go back.
Arambe sees a little cosmic irony here.
You remember 100 years ago, Africa was termed the Dark Continent? Now, you just believe me, that darkness has shifted to Europe and America. The passion for the gospel, the love for Jesus Christ, is way out in Africa, and we bring the same thing back. And isn't that a wonderful thing to see that happen?
That depends on whom you ask. Jim Naughton at the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C. isn't so thrilled. He says this isn't just about evangelism.
It's born of a desire to punish the allies of people who push for gay rights.
Whatever the motivations, these relationships are growing fast and thick. Miranda Hassett spent several months in Uganda studying these new alliances for her book. She says the U.S. conservatives can claim solidarity with the vast majority of Anglicans worldwide. As for conservative Anglicans in Africa and Latin America,
10 years ago, if Henry Arambe said something, it certainly wouldn't be in the American secular media. And today, sometimes it is. So they've gained a vast level of sort of moral influence.
The interesting thing to me in this is not so much that there are, let's just say for the sake of argument, use the term, there are devout Anglicans in the United States distressed with the direction of their church and their bishops. Remember, this is about the bishops and what the bishops will permit or won't permit these congregations to do. Devout Anglicans in the United States casting about, wondering what are we going to do with their given church polity, that's the technical term, with the way that they have their ecclesiastical structure. They can't just say, hey, let's just elect us a new bishop. Let's just find someone to be our bishop. That's not how Anglicans do things. They need an existing bishop to come and lend his support. And it's not leadership. It is his support and his protection. See, the bishop is primarily the protector of the flock. That's what it means, right? Bishop, shepherd. And in this sense, they're right. They can't just go inventing their own bishops. They need to find a bishop who will protect them. Now, how sad is it that they have to go outside the boundaries of the United States? I'm not saying it's wrong for them or it's sad that they have to go to foreign bishops. If you got to go to foreign bishops, you got to go to foreign bishops. But isn't it sad that the state of Anglicanism in the U.S. is such that they can't find them here? What is even more perplexing about this is the reaction of the Episcopal Church USA and its leadership. Now, I'm not going to call them bishops because, with the exception of just a few, they're not behaving like shepherds. They might wear the mitre. They might have all the vestments. They might have had hands put on top of their heads. But some of them aren't qualified. I'm thinking here about Catherine Jefferts Shorey, who, at least in her title, is presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, but is no bishop, no shepherd at all. She's not qualified to hold the office. Her church structure may recognize her as a bishop, but God certainly doesn't. Gene Robinson, obviously not qualified, an unrepentant homosexual, not qualified to hold that office. His church may recognize him as a bishop, but God doesn't. You see, this is the dilemma that the Anglicans in America are dealing with. When we come back, we'll hear more of this story on these foreign bishops.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.